The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Kathleen Kelly Janis, author of Social Startup Success, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
Approximately two-thirds of nonprofit organizations never break through the $500,000 revenue barrier. They hit a wall, live a precarious existence, and never have the opportunity to scale their efforts, even in cases where they are making an impact and a real difference. That is exactly what happened to my next guest with the nonprofit she started. But what she did next was set out on a five-year journey, speaking to over 100 successful social entrepreneurs and their organizations to find out how they broke through this wall and other walls a little further down the line. She is Kathleen Kelly Janis, who is now sharing those findings in her wonderful new book, Social Startup Success, How the Best Nonprofits Launch, Scale Up, and Make a Difference. Good evening, Kathleen, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you so much for having me, Denver.
You started a nonprofit in the Bay Area called Spark. So when you hit your wall, Kathleen, you probably had a few ideas as to why. Now, having completed this book and all this research, were your initial instincts pretty much on target, or did you learn it was something altogether different from what you first thought?
Well, I think as many people find out, you don't know what you don't know when you start a nonprofit organization. When we co-founded Spark, I was a young graduate of UC Berkeley and had just come out of law school and was spending my days billing hours and my nights co-founding this organization to engage young professionals in gender equality philanthropy. And at the time, we were doing it to fill a need, which is how most nonprofits start. You find a problem and you realize that you have a solution and you do what you can to solve that problem. But I had no idea at the time how to fundraise or how to hire or how to measure impact, that it was even important to measure impact. And so this journey of writing Social Startup Success has been, for me, such an important education in how the best nonprofits do these best practices and has been important for Spark as well.
Yeah. Well, you found five key strategies that were common factors in these successful social enterprises who broke through these revenue thresholds. And let's review each, starting with testing ideas. And this is really a period of illumination for a startup social organization. What occurred here?
Well, what I found is that most organizations that succeed tend to have this period where they go out and test ideas before they actually launch their product. Take, for example, Beth Schmidt, who founded Wishbone, an organization that's a crowdfunding organization for low-income students to follow their passions. When Beth started, she was a teacher in Compton. And so, like when I started Spark, she saw this problem that she wanted to solve, which is that her students didn't get to follow their passions in the summer. And so she took some of their essays that they wrote about their passions and photocopied them using an old-fashioned photocopy machine.
I remember those.
And sent them in the mail with a stamp to her family and her friends to say, would you fund these students? And got back thousands of dollars and was able to send these kids to summer camps and to art camps and to film school. And so during this process, she realized not only that she had a great idea and that people wanted to help fund early stage young people to get their ideas off the ground, but that also she was able to figure out what was working and what wasn't. And so she figured out, wow, I can't go out and ask these schools for full tuition. I'll never be able to support the millions of kids that need me. And so she got tuition discounts, or she figured out that technology was going to be a really important platform to give people an opportunity to give and to fundraise for their cause. And so all these little tweaks that she got out so that by the time she went out and started raising money, she knew what she was doing and she had impact to show for it. And that was ultimately what got funded.
And she really had built a culture of innovation in the process.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's what's key, is that it's not just about falling in love with your solution and then getting that solution off the ground. It's about falling in love with the problem.
Yeah.
And about ensuring that you're constantly innovating as you grow, because situations change. Mm-hmm. We have new policies in place, new presidents come into power, and all of that has an impact on your work.
Speaking of impact, the second thing was measuring impact. And I found it interesting is that these organizations started measuring that impact right from the get-go, correct?
Absolutely. And this was a very important trend that I saw in the survey I did of hundreds of social entrepreneurs, is that the organizations they said that began measuring their impact from day one were more successful in their growth trajectory. They scaled more quickly. And when I first saw that data, I thought, well, that makes perfect sense. These are the organizations that go out and have data to show to donors. Mm-hmm. And then those are the ones that get funded because donors want data. But when I went and talked to organizations, I realized that they weren't doing this for the donors at all. And don't get me wrong, donors want data.
Oh, yeah.
But actually, it wasn't about the dog and pony show, that they really genuinely cared about their impact. And if they were not having an impact, they needed to course correct. And mm-hmm. the only way they were going to do that is if they had the data to show it. So, for example, Nick Ehrman from Blue Engine, mm-hmm. a mentoring program for new teachers here in New York City, he wasn't just satisfied with seeing that his assessment numbers in his classrooms were going up. I mean, that was great, but he didn't pat himself on the back and move on. He tested the counterfactual. He wanted to make sure that it was exactly because of their intervention mm-hmm. that those scores were going up. So he hired a PhD for $100 an hour to go out and get the other school district scores to test it against other classrooms. And so really being rigorous in data collection is critical, and it's something that organizations struggle with. 75% of nonprofits collect data. Only 6% of them feel like they're making a good use of that data.
Yeah. It's interesting how the motivation is so important here. It isn't just to raise money. It is that they really care deeply about the problem and trying to solve the problem. And as you point out in the book, you don't have to have lots and lots of data. You really need just a couple of metrics to focus on, right?
Well, and you have to go after them rigorously, mm-hmm. yes. And ultimately, that's what's going to help you tell the data story, is just being laser-focused on those few pieces of data.
The third thing was funding experimentation, testing different revenue streams, which also include earned income. How did some of these organizations go about that?
Well, there is no one-size-fits-all funding model. Mm-hmm. That would be nice if there were. But everyone's got to figure it out on their own. And so what the best organizations do is they figure out how to test both earned income as well as philanthropic income to come up with the funding model that is most suited for that particular mission and that particular area and that particular access to resources. So, for example, Hot Bread Kitchen, also based here in New York.
Yeah, Harlem.
Yes, with delicious avocado toast. I recommend everybody take a visit. When Jessamine Rodriguez started the organization, she thought she was going to be 100% sustainable on the bread that they would sell.
Yeah.
And that would in turn fund their program for low-income women to go into the food industry. Problem is that, first of all, bread has really slim margins, so that was not a great plan. She said, I was on a panel with her recently, she said if she had it all over again, she would have done like pest control or laundry. That would have been a lot more margins for her. But also, she was going to be selling her programs short by not accepting philanthropic income and integrating that to make the programs better even beyond when they might be profitable. So yes, she had incredible sources of earned income, whether it was the bakery where they sell the baked goods that the women make, whether it was the incubator that they charge small businesses to go out and sell food products here locally, or whether it was a wholesale that they were doing to Whole Foods and to JetBlue and other big outlets. Ultimately, it was the 35% philanthropic income that allowed Hot Bread Kitchen to do things like hire childcare help for the women while they were at the program, or keep the women involved in the program longer, even though it wouldn't be profitable, but it was ultimately better for their long-term outcomes. And that's what organizations have to figure out, is what is your mission? Stay laser focused on that mission and then build the funding model around it, as opposed to chasing the money, as we see so many nonprofits do.
Another interesting example you had was Room to Read. How do they go about raising their $50 million?
Well, I love the Room to Read example because they actually got other people to raise money for them, which is every nonprofit's dream.
Love it.
I mean, fundraising can seem like such a lonely path, especially if you're a founder. And, you know, it's the biggest bait and switch as a founder of an organization. You do this work because you're passionate about it. And then, surprise, 99% of your time is going to be spent on fundraising. And what Room to Read did so brilliantly was they figured out that connecting donors with the ultimate outcomes, these libraries that they were building around the world, mm-hmm. or girls' education programs, that this was something that was going to get people really passionate and that they could harness this energy to get even more people involved. And so they created this chapter model where they have 40 chapters around the world. And these chapters raise millions of dollars every year by hosting their own events, by getting their friends and family involved in house parties or jogathons or you name it. They get really creative and they bring them together every single year for a sales conference, basically. It's
great.
Like, you know, the annual sales conference where they bring together their big champions and then they inspire them. They teach them how to fundraise. They make them leaders within their community. So it's a win-win. And I think every organization has the opportunity to find like-minded people who also care about their cause so that fundraising doesn't have to be such a lonely battle.
Nothing like passion, is there,
yes.
when you find those kind of people. Fourth area, and the one where founders said they made their most mistakes, was leading collaboratively. What do they wish they had done better?
Well, what organizations, I think, realize is that the human resources challenge of running a nonprofit is huge. And that it's so critical not only to hire well, but also to fire well. You know, so
right.
often you find that there are employees that are part of the organization that aren't maybe necessarily a good fit, and people stay on too long, and that can really diminish the culture of the organization. And so what I hear from the best nonprofit leaders is that they figure out how to develop hiring practices that are authentic to the organization, that really identify with the culture of the organization. And like Charles Best, mm-hmm. Our friend who we were talking about, Charles Best runs Donors Choose, and he asks every single job candidate, what are you grateful for? Because he has a culture at Donors Choose of really, really strong, positive attitude, people who want to give back. And so if you can't come up with more than like your mom, then that's not, you know, that's not a good answer. He wants people who are grateful for a lot of people in their life. And so developing this culture of really knowing who you are, knowing what you're looking for, and then empowering people within your team at every single level, whether it's your senior leadership, your team, your staff, or even your board of directors, is really critical to success.
And very few have done that any better than Akiva.
Akiva is a fabulous example. The crowdfunding platform for small businesses, for microenterprise around the world. I mean, Akiva had the blessing and the curse of being on the Oprah show very early on. They were featured in Bill Clinton's book, Giving, and raised $11 million overnight and broke their servers. Mm-hmm. And so they had to figure out very quickly how to leverage volunteers, how to create a flat organization that wasn't reliant on hierarchy because they didn't have the time to manage so many people. They had to distribute this $11 million. And so that has become embedded with their culture since day one.
Everybody there feels like an owner. So we have testing ideas, measuring impact, funding experimentation, leading collaboratively, and finally, telling compelling stories. And this pretty much includes everyone connected with the organization, correct?
Absolutely. I think we all have the tendency to hear a great political speech or a great TED Talk and think, wow, that person is just a natural. I wish I could do that. And what I realized in going out and talking with some of these great orators that we've heard is that they make storytelling their Olympic sport, that they go after it and they know that they're not going to build a movement unless they can really get people on board with their words. And so they practice. And my friend Nadine Burke-Harris, who founded the Center for Youth Wellness, talks about her TED Talk on adverse childhood experiences and how this was going to be critical in building a movement in the pediatric sector. And she practiced that speech for 6 months and said that by the time she gave it, that her husband could have given it for her, practically, because she had said it so many times at the dining room table. And so that was critical because she did get millions of views on that TED Talk and has created a movement. And I think what the best leaders realize is that it's not just at the founder level, that every single staff member, every single board member, even your beneficiaries have the potential to be brand ambassadors for your cause. And you have to equip them to go out and tell that story, whether it's at a cocktail party for donors or meeting with new potential partners.
Yeah, Nadine reminds me a little bit of Fred Astaire.
Yes.
Who always used to make dancing look so effortless until you found out that he was almost impossible to work with because he was such a perfectionist and did it so many times over and over again. But it does look like he's a natural when you see him on the screen.
Yes, yes. Even comedians. I mean, every comedian goes out and has their, you know, their practice gigs. And,
yeah, sure.
And so that by the time they get their HBO special, they are game time ready.
Oh, absolutely. You got to have thick skin there. You know, when you watch somebody perform, if they sing or dance, you clap. But nobody ever fakes a laugh.
No, that's true. That's a good one.
Silence can be pretty tough. You know, through this research and surveys and interviews, were you surprised at all what you didn't find? Things that you may have thought would have been indispensable elements to one of these successful organizations, but just wasn't the case?
Well, I tested dozens of factors in my survey, social media engagement, mm-hmm. Different forms of leadership. And, you know, it really did come down to these five. And when I was in my interviews, I kept waiting for someone to just say, well, it's charisma or a great idea or grit or something like that that gets people ahead. And no one said that. And it's not to say that charisma and a great idea aren't critical to an organization's success. Of course they are. But ultimately, it comes down to these tools and strategies that any organization, no matter how big or small, can implement. And to me, that's really exciting as an educator.
Yeah.
You know, I teach at Stanford. I truly believe that these tools are both essential and teachable, and that any organization can become better by implementing them.
You may or may not have found this out, but in speaking to these successful entrepreneurs, did they cite a moment when they knew they were going to make it, or whether it was a big gift or a partnership or securing a board member where they said, aha, we're there. We're going to be a contender.
Every organization has that moment. And, you know, for Latifa Simon at the Center for Young Women's Development, it was when she got the MacArthur Prize that all of a sudden people started answering her calls. Or for Charles Best at Donors Choose, it was a New York Times article that was critical to getting the national attention that he needed to get the crowdfunding platform for teachers off the ground. But ultimately, it started with laying the foundations for success. So success is the combination of preparation and that moment that helps people get ahead.
You live in the Bay Area, Kathleen. As you just mentioned, you teach at Stanford, and you spoke to many nonprofits out there. How much of what you report in the book, which includes organizations from across the country, do you think has been influenced by Silicon Valley mindset and the approach they take to these startup organizations?
It's been influenced immensely by Silicon Valley at every level. And I think in part because donors in the Bay Area in particular, a lot of donors have made their wealth in the tech industry and are applying some of those lessons, like using data, like developing new forms of revenue to nonprofits in a very interesting way. Human-centered design is another example that I talk about in the book, about ways that nonprofits can also integrate this thinking of innovation into their work. And so I think for better or for worse, right? Because, you know, to a certain extent, some of this has swung too much in the wrong direction. I mean, we can't expect nonprofits to be rigorous about their data and collect data and use it well and then turn around and not fund it as donors, right? And so that's what is happening is that, you know, we're expecting a lot of nonprofits without, you know, putting the capacity building behind it. So that is another hope for me out of this research, is that foundations and donors will realize the critical nature of this capacity building support, that we have to provide patient capital to help organizations have the time to get this right. The grants have to be unrestricted so that we're not just focused on the work itself, but that we are also supporting everything that else that goes into that work. You know, we would never go into a restaurant and say, well, I'll pay for the food, but I'm not going to pay for the plate, and I'm not going to pay for the chef's time to prepare the meal. And yet we do that with nonprofits all the time.
Yeah, the restricted funding is nuts. It's like getting a FedEx package and saying, I want none of my payment to go towards gasoline.
Yes, exactly. You're not going to get your package. And so we can't expect nonprofits to deliver under those circumstances. And so while I think that the tech sector and the beauty of innovation has been enormously supportive in unleashing talent and potential in the nonprofit sector, I think that we also have to be aware of where we need to be more supportive of nonprofits and the way that nonprofits operate.
Do you think that these five strategies would be as effective if introduced to a more mature organization, let's say one who's 10 years old, still struggling a little bit, or do you think there's a real special dynamic to startups?
I think any organization can improve their operations. I think it gets harder as you become more mature because people become set in their ways. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of organizations, for example, that start out with a board that is a friends and family board. And, you know, that kind of culture is hard to change down the road. Mm-hmm. But it can be done. And for a lot of organizations, it is a learning curve. And those first 10 years can be critical to learning some of these best practices and ultimately scaling. I just think we don't have 10 years to waste on the problems that we're solving. And so my hope with Social Startup Success is that organizations will be able to accelerate their learning earlier on in the process so that they can ultimately avoid some of these challenges that so many organizations
face. Nothing like getting off on the right foot.
Yes.
You know, we discuss corporate culture a lot on this show, and in the five strategies you've outlined, you sort of touch upon it here and there. But were there any other common threads you picked up in the workplace culture of these organizations which may have also contributed to their success?
It is a little bit of a je ne sais quoi that that you can't put your finger on. You know, I definitely saw it in the organizations. I mean, I had the luxury of actually sitting down in person with the 100 social entrepreneurs that I interviewed for the book. And so I got to go in and see every one of their offices and the kind of the unique cultures that they brought. So many of them in the Bay Area in particular were bringing from lessons from the tech sector. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they had the ping pong tables in their in their break rooms and a certain playfulness that we see in these new companies. And so I think that's kind of a fun way to bring it into as well.
Yeah. Are you a fan, Kathleen, of so many startup organizations in the social sector, or would you perhaps prefer to see more people take that entrepreneurial energy and help build and scale already existing organizations that are doing great work?
I think that the dirty little secret in the nonprofit sector is that there is no cemetery where nonprofits go to die. And so,
never heard it put that way, but I like it.
And many should go to the cemetery.
Yeah, they should.
And absolutely, there are too many nonprofits. And, you know, at Stanford, I think what I've seen in education is that we are telling these young people all over the country that they are the best and the brightest and that they should start organizations. And I think that that is absolutely the wrong message that we need to be sending young people, that we should be addressing problems, not coming up with solutions. And there's a big movement toward systems mapping and having students look at the systems and figure out what are the organizations that are existing within that system, where are the gaps, but then where can their individual skills match up with the organizations that are working to support the causes that they care about. Go work for an organization. And then maybe if you see a gap several years down the road, once you have some experience under your belt, then start an organization. But what I've seen is that so many organizations are started by young people who go into this work with very few tools in their toolkit to address the challenges that inevitably come up when you start an organization. And that I think young people should get some experience under their belt before they start.
Very good advice. So, going back to the beginning of Spark again, and knowing what you know now, what one piece of your own advice would have served you best?
Well, I wish I had had Social Startup Success to read when I started it. It's the playbook that I wanted. And, you know, I think the one thing that we could have done better early on in Spark is getting a better handle on how to measure the impact and using that not just to prove that what we were doing was working, but improving and figuring out where our resources were going to be best used to support young people who wanted to get involved in gender equality issues. And, you know, when you run a network, that's challenging because you never really fully know the ripple effects of your impact and, you know, how one person can hear something at a Spark event and then that causes them to go talk to their HR person about paternity leave. And, you know, we can't trace that back to our work, but certainly that impact is happening. And so getting savvier about how to measure our impact at Spark has been critical to both improving our work as well as getting access to some of this donor money that is looking for more rigorous outcomes.
Let me close with this, Kathleen. You focus your research on strictly nonprofit organizations and not for-profit social enterprises or purpose-driven businesses. And I, for one, am glad you did. I think they're getting lumped together a little too frequently these days. What do you see as the special and still unique role that nonprofits play in our society?
Well, nonprofits are critical as the incubator for government. I saw recently the Elon Musk Tesla on the rocket going to the moon.
Yeah.
And, you know, I thought to myself, first of all, that is just crazy. Imagine if we put all of that energy into social change instead of putting a Tesla on Mars. But I thought, you know, how amazing, like, would that have happened but for innovation external from government? And yes, there is a role for government to play. Government plays a critical role in scaling big ideas to support underserved communities. But ultimately, government will never be small and nimble enough to test solutions on the ground in those communities. And so this is a critical role that nonprofits play in knowing their local community, knowing what people's needs are, having connections and the feedback loop to constantly be improving their programs. And then once you get it right, then scale that program and work with government. And so there will always be a role for nonprofits to play, both for government and then as well as to fill the gap for market failures, you know, and we, you know, we talk about so often people say, well, we need more for-profit social enterprises for social good. The reality is, and yes, that will be an amazing addition to help improve the lives of many people who can be solved by social enterprises. But we can't use market solutions to solve market problems.
Right.
And so the role of nonprofits is to fill that gap where the market is not going to solve people's problems. And that will always be a critical role.
Like human rights.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Kathleen Kelly-Janis, the author of Social Startup Success, How the Best Nonprofits Launch, Scale Up, and Make a Difference. I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Your website is KathleenJanis.com. And aside from being able to purchase a book there, what other information will visitors find?
So many free resources, including my Social Startup Success Evaluation Toolkit, as well as a free fundraising course with all of my best fundraising strategies that people can get with a purchase of the book.
And sign up for your newsletter, too, right?
Absolutely.
Well, great, Kathleen. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.